Well, anyway, I really appreciate the invitation to be here. This is an unusual audience for me to be presenting to. I'm probably, my VCR at home is still blinking 12. And my teenage son is amazed at what I don't understand about how to operate my cell phone and so forth. So I picked up a few security tricks here. But the kind of work that I and my colleagues, Paul Slobick, how many people know his work? Yeah, he was my, I'm not a psychologist, he was my PhD advisor at the University of Oregon, so I got introduced to risk perception at that time. I'm really more of a statistician and a decision analyst. But more recently, in the last few years, I approached Paul and said that there's some methodological issues that we can address in the study of risk perception. And part of it is that we need to move how we look at risk perception from a, what I would call a static concept to more of a dynamic concept. And I'm going to show you a systems dynamic model. I passed out my slides here, so you have it, because I'm not going to be able to go into detail in this length of time for the modeling. But this website right here, you can see all the details of the model. I'm going to show you all the equations, how we did the assessment. But what we believe now is that it's better to study risk perception as an emergent quality. That is, how it emerges after disaster happens. This is where I live in San Diego. We began a couple of years ago to study and create scenarios, some that took place in that downtown area and some in surrounding theme parks. And we would develop small paragraphs and try to make them as realistic as we could and immerse people in this while we could. Now, in comment, this, so we saw some comments about sharks versus airplane parts falling out of the sky, and there was some excellent commentary about that. One of the things we need to understand, we communicate about risk, is that one of the differences there is that they are not emotionally equivalent events. And in late April, the day before I was to give a talk to a bunch of first responders, we had, how many people are aware that we had somebody eaten by a shark off the coast of San Diego in April? Did you read about this in the media? Yeah. And the next day I heard a bunch of first responders saying that I was addressing, oh, the public is irrational. And what were the arguments were they given of why we shouldn't be concerned about sharks? I don't taste good. Well, actually, we're not prey. That's right. What else?
It's too rare.
It's a very rare event. We saw articles in the paper and on the news trying to equate the risk with that it's less likely to be bitten by a shark than be hit by lightning. And this was tried to reassure the public there's nothing to worry about because Southern California is a huge economic incentive to get people back in the water as soon as possible, correct? We're a tourist destination. Well, how many of you, if you're given the choice, would rather be hit by a bolt of lightning or eaten by a shark?
Lightning.
Yeah, that's a good way to go, right? That's a good way to go. And so, but this is often what how we communicate at risk. Don't worry about it. It's less probable this way. Paul and I, a couple of years ago, and I don't expect to, well, for you to understand all the implications of this, but this is a systems dynamic model. In fact, this kind of modeling was developed on this campus, MIT, Jay Forrester, and a number of people, a couple of decades ago, and tomorrow I'm going to meet actually with John Sturman to talk about what we've learned here. He's one of the pioneers in systems dynamic modeling. But what I want to alert you to is this, that Paul Slovak and I met a couple of years ago and said, maybe we can look at risk perception in a different way, not only to better understand how the public might react, but to also help risk managers in the process. And so we built this systems dynamic model as a thought experiment. This is a first generation. It's now published this year in the Journal of Defense Modeling Simulation. But what we basically, these squares you're looking at are stocks or cues. We can keep track of system response. And if you look over here in the far left, it says population at risk. We can say maybe there's 1,000 people at risk at a theme park, and there's some terrorist attack that occurs, and some percentage of them die at a certain rate. this launches some sort of investigatory reaction on the part of federal agencies, local responders, and so forth, that triggers massive media response. And then we looked at how risk perceptions might possibly change and how they may influence the way the public perceives news stories. And we look at the rate at which the public might talk about that story amongst themselves and so forth. And those top boxes where you see status quo, concerned, fearful, and then coming back, what that really models is the diffusion of fear. Diffusion of fear. How quickly would it ramp up? One of the things we discovered was, and we have systematically varied, and I'll show you this here in a minute, but we looked at different types of events. Terrorist events, non-terrorist events, intentional events, and so forth. Terrorist events loom large, way larger than they should, for a reason that was given back here, that terrorists are perceived as predatory. They're in the shark category. They're out to get us. It really does make a difference. And I can't go into all the details about the subtleties. Even simple changes in wording in these scenarios. And we've since not only done cross-sectional studies, but we're in the process of developing a longitudinal study where we actually put people through updated scenarios because we want to see how quickly fear and perceived risk comes down as well afterward. Here is just one example of the output from this model. And if we assume that there's 1 million adults in San Diego, which is roughly correct, and this is percentage along the side, that bold line right there, trajectory, is the perceptions, or excuse me, the fear response. Now, when we use the term fear, we're not using it in the very careful way that psychologists often use it, but more self-protective action combined with some anxiety. Risk perception, notice that fear goes up very quickly, but what do you notice about the decline? Far less, right? This is one of the problems that we face with terrorism. That even the threat of terrorism, can possibly produce this kind of response. We did see this, of course, after 9/11, but actually a month later with the anthrax scare, correct? 5 people died on the East Coast. Notice, though, when you look at public reaction, even on the West Coast, when I interviewed pharmacists, when I interviewed physicians, they were getting demands for antibiotics and vaccines, pediatricians and so forth. There was a massive response. What's interesting is that as soon as we learned that it was probably not connected to international terrorism, our blood pressures came down. But even so, what was the public response in terms of white powder in the mail? Talk to any postal worker on the East Coast. They got, you know, police stations were inundated with white substance. TV coverage ramps up very quickly and then comes down very quickly. But these curves, we believe, and we've checked the validity. It's hard to do with rare events. But if you look at where that curve is at 2 months out, it's roughly between 40% and 50% of the public still in a state of fear, having trouble sleeping and so forth. Studies that were done after 9/11, it's remarkably similar trajectory. So as much as we can validate this model at this point, but this is a very preliminary model. Back in 2004, we collected data where we compared how people might respond to an anthrax attack in a theme park, bomb blast, infectious disease, and propane tank. The infectious disease, accidental release, propane tank, accidental, killing roughly all of them 500 people. We varied it, actually killed no one, killed about 15 people versus 500. Notice that anthrax, both in 2004, 2006, this is a perceived risk where high is at the right-hand side. Notice that infectious disease, bomb blast, loom large, whereas propane tank is down there. That's the public response. When you show the same scenarios to first responders, they have a very different reaction. They're much more concerned about propane tank explosions, chlorine tanks falling over, and so forth. We compared, we went online, changed the methodology, began to develop these scenarios. We compared anthrax bomb blast with earthquake. Earthquake's in the blue. What do you notice about that? Less perceived risk. But I got to tell you, all the people in San Diego and Los Angeles a lot more concerned about the risks of earthquake. Okay, it's devilishly tough in San Diego, and I've heard the same way in Los Angeles, to get people to even prepare in any way for an earthquake. And this is something that most people believe in our lifetimes. There'll be over a seven scale earthquake in San Diego. Now, in anticipating, yeah.
What's in the y-axis?
This is a percentage of people that gave high response. So, for example, this anthrax would be, this is percent of perceived risk, people with perceptions. So about 20%, I can't see it from this angle, but about 20% right here gave it the highest possible rating.
And I'm sorry, they're all in San Diego? There's not people from the East?
These were all in San Diego because this was a local theme park. Okay. And by the way, distance matters. And studies after 9/11, and in fact, I think, George, some of your colleagues at Carnegie Mellon did this, right? And you might have been in on this, where they looked at the distance factor and that geographic distance matters. So the further you're away from New York, I think, the less the perceived risk and so forth. And anticipating this conference, we actually did another study just a month ago where we actually included a cyber attack.
Ooh.
And here's the perceived risk. This is ranked right up there with anthrax, except that when we worried people about why they were giving these things, here they're worried about dying. Here they're worried about their life savings going down the toilet. And so the perceived risk is based on different things.
Did you define cyber attack?
Yeah, I'm going to.
Excellent.
What I do? I know. I think. I thought I had the slide up here. I got to put on my reading glasses.
That's a kind of trade-off. The more worried you are about cyber attack, the less about earthquakes.
Yes. It's not. Did I pull up the? Let me see if I.
I have to do this during questions.
Okay, we better do it. I actually can show you, if you want to see it, the actual scenario for cyber attack. What I did was I modeled it after one of the 15 national planning scenarios by the Department of Homeland Security and took it just like that with the collapse of the massive theft of credit card and so forth in the San Diego area. Okay.
You might see irrational fear. We see job security in this.
Funding for terrorist research has never been better, right? I mean, there are cost-benefit trade-offs, for sure.
That's so not in the next.
The guy who was accused of all of this was on the job, 2 days ago?
Got some money, but probably not nearly enough to make up for the... next, we have Ralph Chatham, formerly of DARPA, now independent random factor.
Right. Independent random factor, that's a pretty good...
We all aspire.
If there's any way to turn down the lights, I've got lots of pretty pictures here that'll show up a little better than... we're going to slide show, set up show. Detect displays. Bingo. All right. And takes a while to... Even a good Macintosh guy has some troubles.
Use the microphone.
I'm going to in a moment. That's a picture of a submarine. That's more important. Thank you. Vividness. It's not going to get any more exciting, so let's just get on with the the rest of this, which I have managed to... Okay. I have some stray comments. I managed to make the second one already. If you don't know about cognitive dissonance, we ought to be paying a good deal of attention. It says you change your beliefs and your attitudes in accordance to what you have done. And as your justifications get pulled out from under you, you put all of your attitudes and beliefs into the thing itself. We won't talk about a particular war, but I will say that boot camp is a perfectly good example of it. It applies in a lot of places. And there's no reward for safety. Who am I? In my misspent youth, I was a submariner and a physicist. I was too susceptible to motion sickness, and the astronaut finalist sent me back to sea. Later on, I chaired some task forces of the Defense Science Board, which I'll talk to you more about. And 3 days after 9/11, I managed to demote myself from the august position of Defense Science Board Task Force Chairman and moved to DARPA to put their money where my mouth was. To do some training things. You may wonder why training is part of this conversation. It's mostly because that's what I've been doing, but I think if you think hard enough, you can see the applications. I also funded the experiment that Mark Frank is going to talk to you about. I had some small input into making it happen. I'm now a private consultant. By the way, the key over there is there's no snake oil. That's part of the Mark Frank and Paul Ekman experiment. I'm a private consultant and a storyteller and a physicist and an all-purpose curmudgeon. But back when I was doing the Defense Science Board work, there are a couple of throwaways. It turns out that as we have changed the nature of our war, everybody has to think. People are as important as hardware, and all the money goes to the hardware guys, so you have to really work hard to get them to pay attention to people. And the whole business of R&D on people things is woefully underfunded compared to the power of what they might do. And here's why. This is an unintended warfare experiment with controls and everything. This is air-to-air engagement ratio, which means that, exchange ratio, which means the number of times we shot down a bad guy versus they shot one of us. And for 3 years during the Vietnam War, it was about an average of 2 to 1. The Navy decided it was getting even worse. They invented the Top Gun school, and after a year, the Navy's exchange ratio was 12.5 to 1 for the next 3 years, and the Air Force hung in at 2 to 1 for the rest of the war. They finally scraped the navy blue paint off of it and painted it their colors and called it Red Flag. But the Army went into this practice in a huge way. A whole brigade of soldiers goes in, that's 3,500 soldiers, goes into the Fort Irwin, which is the National Training Center, and they create an artificial war. They fight against the best soldiers the Army can create, who are fighting the war du jour with the tactics of the enemy du jour, and they tailor the thing to fit the user's needs. They execute a mission. They get beaten, plastered by the Red Force. They measure the process and the outcome, and they have a no-holds-barred after-action review where the soldiers talk back to their lieutenants, and the lieutenants encourage it. The Army is the only large organization I know in the world which has institutionalized over 25 years the process of introspection. Then you do it over and over again. You still get plastered. But within 3 weeks... you have changed your proficiency likelihood to beat the Red Force in a matter of a factor of 35 for small units and 5 for large units. This is important. You can do this for arbitrage. Somebody did that when they introduced the euro and made a bundle. I can't tell you who it was. So why don't we do it all the time? Well, the problem is it doesn't scale. You can't get to everyone. And it costs a lot of money to build that organization, the National Training Center. 250 Iraqi-American play actors don't come cheap. Improvisational theater with 3,000 guys and tanks thereto appertaining costs a lot. You can't do it all the time, and you actually have to go there. So we asked the question, could you create simulation-based training on common hardware, PCs? I'm sorry, I would have preferred on Macintoshes, but PCs were the creature du jour of the Defense Department, that everybody could play on everywhere. I was going to tell you about anatomy of learning curves, but I don't have time, so I'm just going to go through that. They're also forgetting curves. This is 100 years after the last DTL information on forgetting, but it still says, intellectual things you lose with a time scale of about 90 days. You can still ride bicycles. So we came out with the takeaways were training counts. We don't measure it. And because we don't measure it, the rest of the Defense Department can ignore us. So I created DARWARS. DARPA's Universal Persistent On-Demand Fill in Your Own Adjective Here Training Wars to try to bottle the National Training Center and export it electronically. Here's one example. This is, how do I teach caveman Arabic to the brain behind every trigger finger? Culture, gesture, and mission-oriented vocabulary, because we'll never have enough linguists. And we built it on top of a computer game. If you look in the upper right of that top thing, there is a trust meter. It's stolen directly from the, modified from the game weapons load meter from Unreal Tournament. You can if I can walk through here, I bet you I can. Right, I did green laser pointers when I was in DARPA the last time, but we'll use red for those of you who are colorblind, you're stuck. This is a speech recognizer. You click on this, and your digital aid tells you how to say Ani Ismi or Ani Ismi John, and then you try it, and it measures, and whether it's good enough, and it actually says, it sounds like you said Ani Ismi John. When you get good enough, it says, go out into the world and try it. And so you go into this world, mouse and keyboard your way up to this character, click on the right mouse button, because if you hit the left one, it says, I'm sorry, you can't shoot in this game, you've got to talk your way out. you dial your gesture, you touch G to take off your sunglasses to be polite, and you say, Assalamu alaikum. And if you've done it right, your character will do the right bow, put the hand over the heart, and this digital guy will say, Wa alaykum as salam, back to you, and a little green plus sign will go up, and the trust meter goes higher. And you have a mission, you've got specific things that you've got to do, and if you do them well, the guy offers you his card. If you walk away without saying thank you, as I did when I didn't know that they put that into the game, a few minutes, you walk 10 yards, virtual yards, and he shouts to your virtual back, Lek gul shukran kelb bin il kelb, which means literally, you didn't say thank you, you son of a bitch. Dog, son of dog. You're kicked out of the damn game, and you got to start over again, told that you're not polite. Pay attention to the niceties of these things. This is 2 discontinuous weeks. 10,000 soldiers at least are using it this year. And when you're really tired and bored, you can go through a Pac-Man-like thing with monsters and all, but you move yourself through it by uttering commands in Arabic, like turn right at the river, go backwards. Another example, we've got that in Pashto and French and Dari. The people who built it are also building a tactical language and culture trainer for the Cherokee Nation, for their youth. So there are spin-offs. I will not read this. There was a question of how we can handle ambushes, and I created a tool. This is what it looked like. This guy is moving in the motor pool. He's going to become the gunner on this vehicle. This guy's going to be his driver. And this whole team will fight against the squad next door who creates an ambush to bust them. We thought it was an ambush trainer. We sent these off. We created it in 6 months, which is a pretty sporty business in the game world. But the soldiers who got it thought it was more. This guy, this colonel, has created we had a digital terrain. He created a sandboard of the digital world that we had created. And when somebody gets hurt, the medic hops up off of his computer over here, goes to the sim man dummy, puts in the airway, and then goes back and registers that in the computer game. If you got to search a vehicle, they hop out, they go out this door, and in the shadow of Mount Rainier, there is the vehicle, there's the dog, and they sniff it, and then they go back and enter it in the game. My favorite one was when this character had to create a tornado damage for a disaster relief exercise, so he got a platoon of virtual tanks, ran through it, smashed the trees and the cars. There are a bunch of myths of games and training, and I'm getting the axe here, so I'm going to go really fast. The last thing I want to tell you about that I did was a digital troubleshooter. It's the real thing. This thing is like a tutor. It looks at you. It measures what you're doing, and it gets focused like people playing computer games. My son playing World of Warcraft is no more dedicated than this guy. This is our competition. Notice this web-based training. Motherboard. that's the crap that we have to train around. What should be next? We should train non-kinetic stuff, all the things you didn't join the Army to do, all of this sort of thing. You have to build people engines, not physics engines. You have to build mindscapes, not landscapes. You have to have libraries of behaviors and training and cultural, and it's a really cool thing, but it's not going to happen today because the director of DARPA didn't want to buy it. With luck, I will be out of here. I was supposed to tell you about funding. The DOD wants to know about individuals. Who's going to shoot me versus the scientists who are happy with how many encounters have somebody getting killed? You got to change the rules. NSF has a different class of a way of delivering funding. DARPA, you just be outrageous and tell them it's going to create a revolution, and maybe they'll even give you enough funding to do it. But you don't have enough. Nobody's going to give you a large enough population to get adequate statistics on human behavior stuff, and that's going to be your biggest problem. Get your funding now, because the supplementals are going to stop, and then we're going to have to recapitalize the Army and the Navy and the Air Force. And so, if you got any way of getting money today, do it now. Don't hope that it's going to be better in the future, because it's not likely to. And my whimper is, I'm afraid that the wrong lessons are going to be taken from all of this stuff. And at their best, this kind of training is great. At its median, it's god-awful.
It'd be a long whimper.
Yep.
Could I have a light scan, please?
Thank you. Always must take this thing off.
Next, we have Lori Craner from Carnegie Mellon. Probably
going to talk to us about late birds. It was the intent. If I can't say anything substantive, at least I can say it loud.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about what we do at CMU in the Usable Privacy and Security Lab. And you can see I have lots of students, so we're doing way more than I'll have time to talk about in 10 minutes. Also wanted to put in a plug, if you like this event, come to Suits in a few weeks. I have flyers in the back room if you're interested. And if you can't make it this time, next summer we'll be in Mountain View at Google in July. Okay, also wanted to mention that besides doing research at CMU, we're actually teaching courses in usable privacy and security. We have a book which I co-edited with Simpson Garfinkel, and we have an instructor's guide which is online. So if you're interested in something like this, check it out. And if you have additional resources or related courses, let us know and we will add them to the guide. Okay, so the focus of our lab is we've been looking at the human threat to secure systems, but rather than the traditional security approach where people just look at the malicious attackers, we're also looking at the people who are usually considered the good guys. And these people are also threats to secure systems for a variety of reasons. Probably familiar with most people in the room. People may not know what they need to do in order to properly use a secure system. They may be unmotivated to actually do it. They may have other priorities. So there are all sorts of reasons that the good guys actually don't do what they're supposed to do and can be actually threats to your secure system. Okay. So how do you make secure systems more usable in light of these threats? There have been sort of three approaches that have been discussed in the literature, and there have also been debates about which is the best approach. Our answer is actually all of these need to be done, and depending on the context, it depends which combination of these things is going to work the best. But the first approach, which we heard about this morning, I guess this was John's favorite approach, is to make it just work. That way the user doesn't have to do anything. Another approach is to make it understandable, come up with really intuitive things that users can understand. And then the third approach, which we've just heard about, is training. Train the users so that they know what they're supposed to do. So in our laboratory, we have a variety of projects that have been ongoing. I'm going to give you a few very quick highlights. The four areas that I grouped them in, the first one is a human-in-the-loop framework, which I'm going to tell you about in a minute. Then we have a number of projects related to privacy decision making. So when people decide whether or not to take proactive actions to protect their privacy, how do they make those sorts of decisions? So we have a number of projects in that area. We also have a number of projects in an area we call supporting trust decisions. This is basically anti-phishing. So when people have to make that decision, is this email from my bank or is it from an attacker, how do they decide, or do they even know that this is the decision that they're making? And then the last area is user-controllable privacy and security. So sometimes we have applications where end users actually have to configure security or privacy in a variety of different settings. And so we have a number of projects to try to figure out how to put these controls in the hands of end users realistically. So one of the things that have inspired this work, there's been a lot of discussion of taking things from other disciplines. We've looked at the science of warnings. There's a wonderful book, any of you are interested, edited by Michael Wolfelter, called The Handbook of Warnings, which these are papers from people who design railroad crossing signs, who design labels on medicine bottles, who design those nutrition labels, which, by the way, they actually do change behavior. Somebody said earlier that they don't. They may not do it as much as we'd like, but there is some evidence they do change behavior. So we took a lot of inspiration from this. And we developed something called the Human in the Loop Framework, which I presented at the UPS conference earlier this year. And I don't have time to go through it in detail, but let me just give you an overview. The notion is that when you have a secure system that relies on a human to do something, be it when a pop-up pops up and says your virus software is out of date, you know, update it, or if it's your anti-phishing warning, you know, the light turns from green to red, whatever it is, the human has to respond and do something. There's some sort of a communication. The communication might also be the corporate security policy that you got 3 years ago that you're supposed to remember to follow. But somewhere there's a communication of some form. And this is sent to the human. And there are a variety of things that can happen before it gets to the human. It may not actually get there because the human might be distracted by other things going on, environmental stimuli. There might be actual interference, and that interference might be malicious, so in the form of an attacker who's actually preventing you from getting the signal. It's blocking the pop-up or whatever. Or it might be just natural things that are going on anyway that happen to also be interference. But if the message actually gets to the human, there's a whole bunch of things that happen, a whole bunch of information processing steps that happen in order for the human to decide what to do with it. And these are going to be impacted by personal variables, so the kind of background, educational experience, and life experience a person has. Also, their attitudes and beliefs. Do they believe that they should actually pay attention to the security communication, or is it somebody else's problem? Have they seen so many false positives that they no longer trust or care about it? Are they motivated? What are their capabilities? Do they think it's asking to do something that they are incapable of doing? Then there are also questions about whether they have noticed the communication. So we had some discussion earlier about the lock icon. There have been a number of studies that show that a lot of people are completely unaware of the existence of lock icons in browsers. Okay, they've never seen them. There are other people who've seen them but have no idea what they mean. So then we have a comprehension problem. And then potentially when we have a security communication that you have to remember, so this corporate security policy or something like that, then we have a knowledge retention and knowledge transfer problem. Oh, you know, I saw it 3 months ago. I don't remember it now, or I didn't realize that it applied to this situation. So after we've gone through all these different steps of the human receiver, hopefully we will have a behavior, and hopefully that behavior is the desired behavior. So that's the framework. In the paper, there's actually a table that which gives you a set of questions you can actually step through a process and try to understand where the problems might be. Then how do you use this? What we also suggest in the paper is that you start with your security task and say, what exactly is the task that I'm trying to do, and where are the human critical components in the task? Once you've identified those, then the question is, can we actually eliminate any of them? Can we make it just work and not have the human actually have to do any of these tasks? Then the next step is for those that we can't eliminate, those that we still require the human to do, then we go apply that framework to try to understand where the human might actually fail in these tasks. And we might do some user studies to test this and see how likely the human is to fail at these tasks. And then finally, we try to come up with ways of mitigating the problems. And again, we may need some more user studies. And then we loop. Because it may turn out that the human is really bad at some of these things, and maybe automation is looking more and more appealing, even if we can't do automation with 100% accuracy. All right, so let me just, in my remaining time, give you a quick overview of some of our other projects. In the privacy decision-making area, we have a search engine which gives you privacy information, annotated search results. We've been doing studies where people come into our lab and we have them make purchases, and we look to see whether they're willing to pay more money for websites with better privacy policies. Just for fun, and in order to test whether privacy-sensitive purchases make a difference, we've had all sorts of interesting privacy-sensitive items, which some of you have heard me talking about before, purchasing. In the supporting trust decisions project, we have a number of projects where we're looking at automating detection of phishing, but we're also looking at user education. So I was very interested in the last presentation because we have a number of user education programs. One of them is user education by sending people simulated phishing messages. When they click on the link, then we give them education. We've demonstrated that this is a teachable moment. People are much more receptive to the education. We also have a video game, Anti-Phishing Phil, which the Air Force has expressed interest in using, although they want it to be more Air Force-y. We've tested both of those actually with lab studies as well as with field studies by putting the game on our website. We've done some studies of browser anti-phishing warnings to find out whether anybody actually pays any attention to them. This was a very difficult lab study to set up because we didn't want people to know that that's what we were testing, or they would have, of course, all have paid attention to it. But we did come up finally with a way of doing this, and what we found was that some browser anti-phishing warnings are a lot better than others. The Firefox one is very good. Some of the others, not so good. And then finally, in the user control privacy and security area, one project we have is using smartphones for access control. I use a smartphone, this phone actually, to open my office door. Again, as I mentioned earlier to some people, originally when I started using it, I often had to reboot my door. usability. Now it works very well, and I even get a nice pleasant beep when I open my door. We also have a system where we're looking at how to visualize file permissions in Windows XP. It turns out people are very bad at setting file permissions, and they often make mistakes that are actually very critical. We've come up with some approaches to using a visualization, which we've demonstrated in lab studies, actually make it much easier for people to get it right and set their file permissions correctly.
Thank you. Next up, we have Mark Frank from SUNY Buffalo. Like, we're getting good at swapping laptops out.
Yeah, we're going back PC, though. Watch it. That's right.
I don't know. The Macs have been having more trouble getting up on the screen.
I'm really simple.
Watching F5.
You're just looking personal, didn't you?
I didn't have trouble.
Almost don't know what to do with this extra 2 minutes that I was anticipating on the transition. I'm going to talk about detecting deception, but sort of some of the methods involved here, because the methods are important in terms of, I think, any time you're sort of dealing with people and technology and so on. And so some of the principles sort of derived out of this, I think, can apply to a few others. Some other folks involved, this is in collaboration with Paul Ekman. And thanking to Ralph, who helped fund some of this, Jonathan Phillips, a variety of cast of thousands. The bad guys, obviously, are up on deception. These are some passages taken from the Al-Qaeda manual and some of our kind of greatest hits here of folks. And so, again, they are very much up on this, and they very much practice it. Now, this is really kind of counterintelligence 101. The Al-Qaeda manual is really sort of clippings from our manuals, Russian manuals that they sort of put together over the years. The question, though, we have is how good are people can do this? How good are the people that we entrust as a society to detect those who may have some sort of malfeasant intent? And so the first thing you naturally do, of course, you're going to look in the literature and say, all right, what have the scientists found? What kind of behaviors might be useful for spotting somebody who is up to no good? And this is what we're going to try to do today, is really sort of raise some of these research issues in terms of what are some of the processes, principles, and problems associated with trying to generalize from laboratory studies to the real world. Because, as we all know, they're very different. But in this domain, they're really different. And a lot different than you think. And in fact, in a way that I think is going to cause a lot of what actually is going to hurt our nation's security rather than help. And so we need to really spell these things out here. And then I'm going to give you one example of a project that we did that Ralph helped fund for us and to show how that may look a little bit different. Depending on how you look at the literature, there are some quotes. The first thing here, it says, behavioral information not so useful in detecting deception. However, a lot of it is taught. A lot of it taught in law enforcement. In fact, a lot of the stuff that's taught in law enforcement, there's no actual evidence that it works. But that turns out not to be an impediment to getting it used. And in fact, it's sometimes better and easier to get it used if you don't have evidence. If you have evidence, people will nitpick and attack it and delay it and obfuscate. If you don't have evidence, well, as long as you've been doing it for a while, that's usually enough. Okay? And so the guy without evidence typically is a leg up on those with, depending on the agendas of those associated. So the assumption is, look, there is nothing useful in the behavior in terms of detecting deception from a nonverbal point of view. Although, again, some of it's being taught. But the problem is, if you look at the research literature, the social science work on deception, most of it has little or no ecological validity to the situations in which it matters that we catch bad guys. Because, again, we entrust some people to do this for us, whether you like it or not. You may not like people, airports, whatever, but police officers and so on, they are entrusted to do this. So the question is, what do you want to do? And sometimes in academia, we like to complain about, that. Oh, these cops, they stink. They can't do it. They can't do anything right. But we're not willing to help them. We just want to criticize. But we need to really take a closer look at this literature to see if there's anything there that is useful for them. But the biggest problem we have here, I think, is that most social science makes the assumption that a lie is a lie is a lie, that all lies are the same. So go, let's play a little game. If I haven't met you, tell me a date. I'll ask you your birth date, and you either lie or tell the truth. And if we do it, this little game here, it has absolutely no relevance to the type of lies that matter in a security context. Although the assumption is this is what people want to detect. They think there's going to be a given lie. But you need to look at this more carefully. Now, there are some things that are associated with lying, and Paul talked about this morning, so I'm not going to spend very much time on this. But basically, signs of cognition or mental effort, signs of emotional reaction. This is what I said Paul had talked about. Those things do get correlated with deception, but they're not exclusive to deception. There's typically other reasons why these things can occur. So I want to take you through some sort of compare and contrast of laboratory and the real world to give you a sense of how that may affect the type of results that one may see. So the stakes associated with deception, okay? What happens if you get caught? What happens if you get away with it? The vast majority of laboratory studies, the answer is nothing. All right? In the real world, you get caught lying, you can get shot. You get away with your lie, you can literally get away with murder. The stakes are considerably higher. In the laboratory, of course, because of IRB restrictions, you can't get it as high as we could in the real world. But we've had a good go at it. We've been able to do things like, threaten people with 1 hour of loud, startling blasts of noise if you're caught, well, in our case, actually judged deceptive. And if you lie and get away with it, you get $175. Okay? We can do that sort of stuff. The implications on that are, you can imagine, are pretty enormous. How do you feel knowing if you get caught in a lie, you're going to have to be detained for an hour and have to listen to these loud, startling blasts of noise, versus if you get caught in a lie, nothing happens? You can, again, envision what's happening to your emotional system. Okay? So, implication, right? The types of clues that are going to be correlated are going to be different. Now, here's one that's a little bit funkier, choice. We think of it as experimental psychologists. We say, well, yeah, obviously, random assignment. You got to have random assignment. But in the real world, people are not randomly assigned. In the real world of the security world, where people are trying to lie, get away, terrorists, etc., are not randomly assigned. For the most part. Some people are blackmailed into it, maybe, and so on. But in the real world, it's a choice. And when you think about what might happen behaviorally, with choice, you got to own it. You made that decision. You got to live with it. You know, you're responsible for it. Your perceptions of it are going to change accordingly. If you're forced at gunpoint tell a lie, you don't feel so bad about lying. Okay? But if you chose to lie to somebody, you may be more likely to feel bad about it. Now, by the way, I don't think a terrorist feels bad about lying, and that's another situation. Okay? But again, you get increased emotional buy-in. And again, that's going to affect the type of behaviors you might see. What about subjects in the laboratory, undergraduates? Now, by the way, one of the things about 9/11 was the fact that usually the first thing somebody in the government will do when you run an experiment on deception, well, those are just college students. But it turned out a lot of the 9/11 hijackers were college students. So for once, it was appropriate. But there's another element besides just simple college students. In the real world, when you're thinking in terms of counterterrorism, you're dealing with people with different world views. I am right, you are wrong. Whereas with an undergraduate, they may not care about anything outside of maybe the new Coldplay, CD that's coming out or some other kind of a thing, all right? Whereas these are very different world views, all right? Now, that has a lot of implications about how you interact with this person trying to catch you. If the person trying to catch the lie you think is the Antichrist, you know, you're going to have a different perspective on how you're going to feel about lying to that person than if it's just some other random person. You don't have any agenda in that interaction. You know, you're probably less likely to feel guilt lying to that person. You're probably going to be more motivated to try to beat that person if, in fact, that's what you're trying to do with your lie. And again, this is going to affect the type of clues that you might be able to detect. The interview itself. In most laboratory work, there's often not even an interview. It's just here, describe this picture. And, you know, somebody will sit there and you'll say it to a camera. There's not even another person there. Or maybe they're very tightly scripted. A lot of closed-ended questions. In the real world, of course, it can be longer, much more intense. There's follow-ups. Now, again, from a scientific point of view, as you start to follow up, it's much, much harder to control that. But you get more open-ended questions. Again, implications. Fatigue. All right? We used to know, and I'm back in the day when I used to build swimming pools, that if we had some, you know, rookie out there, if we wanted to sort of find out a lot of personal details, we always asked him at the end of the day when he was tired. You know, and he would always give up all sorts of information about his girlfriend or whatever, which was great, so we could make fun of him. Right? Those were the old days, but fatigue did that. Okay?
Are you still a bad man?
No. Amount of information, and also in terms of what you have to score and analyze and rate, and again, the type of clues. And just to sort of speed up, also the nature of relationship. In most, you know, college, in most laboratory studies, it's a graduate student doing the interview, whatever. Where again, in the real world, oppositional, you've got professionals, older people, all this other kind of business. So, we do a study trying to take some of these things into account. And in fact, what we did is we put together a panel of experts to design it. So we had people from U.S. military intelligence, law enforcement, CIA, Scotland Yard, Israeli police. We spent 2 days hashing out a paradigm saying, what are the essential elements of a counterterrorism situation? The nature of the relationships amongst people, the choices they make, all this other sort of stuff, and the incentives. And you find, you know, rationale, lying's not wrong, different worldviews, clear punishments. Plus, we also found in this unique group rewards as well as individual rewards. They have an opportunity to steal a check. It's made out to a group they don't like. We use retired FBI guys, all looking fierce. And they do a brief interview. We collect a lot of behavioral measures as well as physiological measures. So we measure facial thermography. This is a laser that actually measures his heart rate shooting off the carotid. There's a pupil dilation. We analyze the behaviors in the face, the body, and in the voice. And when we start to put this stuff together and fuse the data, and a rock curve just for you, Ralph, if you love them, and you start to look at, this is logistical regression, you make a particular cut point, make an optimized descent, you know, you can actually correctly sort them out about 86.5%, which is really quite phenomenal. And a lot of it going here in the video sensor basically means behavioral information, and that's in this particular curve on the rock curve. And when you actually fuse all these sources together, what's going on in behavior, in their words, with the thermography and the pupillography, you do a pretty good hit rate, all things considered, on this. So, what does it all mean? I think first off, it says basically you get different result patterns with high ecological validity. We can find some pretty good detectability once we start to sort of plan this stuff out and try to make it a little bit more realistic. What it also means, it's a mistake to just simply do meta-analyses. One of the things that the field of deception detection does is they just do these meta-analyses and throw every study together. So the study where you have no stakes, it doesn't matter where you get caught, is put together with one where you have high stakes. And then, of course, their effect sizes wash each other out. But in fact, the Defense Science Board did that recently in their review of behaviors in detecting deception. They just sort of lumped all these things together. They didn't sort out the high-stake ones from the low-stake ones. And we have data to suggest that we just sent out this paper, actually, that they differ. Moreover, everyone loves technology in the government, and fMRIs are the big thing in terms of detecting deception. However, it finds out that if you don't understand the behavior, well, guess what? These fMRIs turn out not to be all that useful. They are sometimes very simple tasks. Did you pick this card? Did you pick that card? Well, all you got to do is inject some emotion, and you create so much noise you can't analyze the fMRIs. But without that, when you have a very simple cooperative subject, they do a great job sorting out liars and truth tellers. Remarkably good. A little emotion, a countermeasure that's actually in the Al-Qaeda manual, repeat some passages of the Quran. You do those things, you get so much noise you can't analyze it. Right? These also are measurable behaviors we can see, so you can hotspot them, you can train people to see them, and of course it's got implications for our ability to automate that stuff, which we also have some systems now try to analyze the behavior automatically. So again, I think it becomes essential to really think through the paradigms here and to really try to capture those structural features of the real situation and understand them before we go on generalizing to other situations in the world. Thanks.
All right, thank you. Subject size while the next one's setting up.
In that group?
How many people did you do this
for? In terms of had the money to fund to analyze? 132.
Which is way out of the range of any other kind of experiment.
Most of these studies do about 40.
So Stuart's our last speaker from Microsoft.
Okay, so if I want to do experiments on people who believe that have the worldview that they're right and you're wrong, I just use my toddler. Do we have that? Great. And this always looks crooked to me in this room. Does this look crooked to any of you?
The room is crooked.
Well, has anyone tried to use the adjustment here for the rotation? No?
Can you rotate the room?
No. Is that better? Okay. Great. I'm Stuart Schechter. I'm from Microsoft Research, and I have a hard time keeping up with all the other miscreants here, but I'll do my best. So, who am I? I am somewhere between you and your dinner, and as I said, I'm a researcher at Microsoft Research. I produce public goods, although some of you who have read some of my papers might say I produce public bads, but mainly they're focused on security, and in addition to the research I do at Microsoft, I'm also on an advisory board there they call the Trust User Experience Advisory Board that advises product groups on usability and security of products and on the methodology for testing them. So I test generally two things, one, existing assumptions about security behavior, and I design guidelines for improving user safety and try to test those as well. You might also know me from the prior work I have that's relevant, which is work in which we tested these security images to see that people are supposed to see before they're personalized images. You're supposed to make sure it's there before you enter your password, and we gave them this message here. Bank of America is currently upgrading our award-winning site key feature. Please contact customer service if your site key does not reappear within the next 24 hours. That worked on 92% of people who were using their own usernames and passwords. We've had some discussions of definitions of security that have come up, and I wanted to sort of bring up mine, which is very similar. Everyone else brings up that there's this adversary here, and you've got some potential or immediate threat from these adversaries. And so this security behavior study is studying the human response to this potential or immediate threat. And so if we want to experiment, it's just extending these words a bit more, the process of testing this human response to this potential threat, which means, well, heck, the potential threat had better be there, or we can't measure the response. So the challenge here, if we want to observe real security behavior, is that the behavior, and there was a lot of great ecological validity discussion earlier, the behavior may change if no threat's perceived. Now, when I do a banking study, it's it's considered acceptable for us to fake the risk and make people think that their banking credentials may actually be at risk. Obviously, it would be much harder to get through an IRB, a study where you tried to convince people that if they did the wrong thing, there's an 80% chance they'd die, because that might just induce a heart attack and increase the odds a little bit. behaviors may change, of course, if people know they're being observed or based on their observation, and may change if a participant knows that you're studying security behavior, as I think was also previously mentioned, so I'll just pass right over that. So questions that intrigue me was, I think, the last thing we were asked to discuss in our brief time, and I'm going to start with one that involves a sacred cow that I would like to I don't eat cows, but maybe I need a new leather couch. And I'm going to talk about computer security sacred cow. It's very hard to find anyone in computer security who will say a bad thing about defense in depth, right? Here, if you want to prevent something bad from happening on the user's computer, well, first, it's going to have to go through the firewall, and then it will have to go through some kind of proxy, and it's going to run antivirus, and then there'll be another warning system and operating system protections, and another independent layer is always good. That's generally a fairly safe orthodoxy that no one questions, I'd say, much in computer security. But if you look at the human analog, say we'll take three police officers and ask them all to watch and make sure that one of them sees and reports when they see a criminal, well, this is where the original diffusion of responsibility, the inspiration for that research, came out of. You expect a bunch of people to report when something goes wrong, and all of them assume, well, I'm not sure, but you know, if it's really happening, I'm sure someone else has reported it by now. Another good example that I've heard discussed in some of the side discussions is when you force people to wear seatbelts. So if we add new things that help protect users, well, they're just going to behave in a more risky manner, because they know you're protecting them. So if we add the phishing filters that are in Firefox and Internet Explorer, if you add these things, well, then what happens when you get to a site that's not on the list of known phishing sites? Well, I've been warned when there are things that are bad happening to me, so if there's no bad warning, it must be safe. So this diffusion of responsibility is something that I think is a very basic psychological concept from, you know, Psych 101 that seems to have seems not to be discussed when you're dealing with defense in depth. So one of the questions that intrigued me that I think is worth discussing is, can we protect people without inciting them to take more risks? How do we warn people of danger without desensitizing them? And a third one would be how to motivate secure behavior when the risk, as I think this has also been widely discussed, well, is low, but the potential loss is high. So when you multiply them together, it's something they really should care about, but because the probability is so low, they ignore it. So that's the end of my talk, and we can get into the fun part.
This was a kind of far-ranging panel.
What was the last one?
Now we're
going to
have a question.
How to motivate secure behavior
in risk? More common
when the probability is low, the damage is high.
My own work, particularly as I described in my most recent book, suggests that two of those vivid sorts of threats are A, the threat of predators, and B, the threat of infection.
Right. We actually found this when we systematically looked at, when we compared anthrax to bomb blast, anthrax scores a little bit higher.
Yeah.
And this is a long history, going back 30 years of the early psychometric work on this, where infectious disease and things like this, you can't see it.
Yeah.
It could kill you right away, it could kill you 20 years from now, share some of the properties to radiological sort of stuff. Scared to die in an explosion, but scared you still to not be able to rattle and stuff. So you're absolutely right. Yeah.
If you look at say, military propaganda to incite people to go to war, you find these threats consistently for hundreds, if not thousands of years. The enemy is either a non-human predator or it's a vector of infection. It's very motivating.
A scientist at the University of Minnesota, an epidemiologist, who's, I think he's a advisor to the president of the world, Michael Osterholm. And he's been on Oprah and he's been all this. He was really one of the first to alert us in a public way to the threat of the pandemic flu and what this might happen. And so when we were designing these scenarios a couple of years ago, I called him. And he gave me about half an hour of his time and said, we need to look at anthrax. Because I was thinking, maybe we'll design these scenarios around smallpox. He said, well, you know, first of all, smallpox doesn't exist in a natural state. We got rid of that in the late 70s. This would clearly be a terrorist attack. We were not sure how likely this. We got lots of stockpiles by now of vaccines and all this. Anthrax, the ability to reload, as he put it, is scarier still. And so he helped us actually design the scenarios.
Stuart, one of the other, you know, I think it's important to point it out with the that basically the risk when you put the countermeasure in place, it changes people's behavior. I think that's very key and that's often overlooked. Another point is that when you put a security measure, it can actually shift the distribution of risk between different stakeholders. And sort of coming back to what I was saying, basically it's the deployment of is the people who are in control basically like to shift the risk onto the other party, right? So when you put immobilizers into cars, you may reduce the number of car thefts, but you get carjacking, or in Germany, basically the number of houses being burgled in association with the car crime going through the roof. And if you ask people about it afterwards, they would say, well, take my car, you know, but I don't want to have my home burgled as well. I don't want to basically get shot or severely injured in the process. I was wondering if that's a backing scenario that's being considered when you put a countermeasure in, how that shifts the risk between the customer and the bank.
So, in the bank case, I guess I don't have comment on the bank case. I will say that one of the things that we're very clear on in the advising product groups on what they should and shouldn't do is that you shouldn't put up a dialogue box just to transition, just to make it clear that it's the user's responsibility. The something bad's about to happen. Are you okay with that? Dialogue boxes are something we'd like to avoid.
There's only one problem with that. Is you condition users to swat away boxes for the last 10 years.
Yes. we have...
Found out Stuart first.
Swatting right. away that box and taking the warnings in.
Which is why making the another one of the things we advise is that the default button should always be the secure option. So if we've trained people to just hit OK, OK should be the thing that's going to be the safest.
I have a question similar to this notion of the transferring risk. I mean, you can read about a risk thermostat that people have, that if they wear motorcycle helmets, they will drive faster. Now, it seems that the risk thermostat only works very locally. It won't be that if you wear motorcycle helmets, you take up smoking. You'll do something very directly in that environment, potentially to increase your risk, and possibly not enough to compensate. So you're going to increase your risk maybe as the perceived difference of wearing the helmet will make you safer, not the actual. So if you do this right, it seems like you should be able to make someone more secure or safer, even taking into account this risk thermostat, which will allow some compensating behavior. I'm just curious if anybody has done work on that. I think this seems very relevant here. Please.
A question I asked Bill, but he didn't answer it, but, about whether or not to get a trade-off between anxiety about one issue and anxiety about another. I mean, whether there's only a limited number of things which we can keep in mind and worry about. And,
in other words, do we have some sort of quota or capacity for worry?
Yeah. But would you expect
for example, if but through Turkey had become a global threat, so we start worrying less about terrorism or about earthquakes, for example. And I mean, is there been a kind of conversion of
exactly? You know, it's a very interesting question, and I don't know the answer. I haven't specifically researched it, but I'm going to argue that probably the answer is yes, that there is. There's only so many hours a day to worry about stuff and resources, and we probably, you know, being fearful is a very uncomfortable emotion. And so people don't like to be there for very long, and likewise for anxiety. There's a lot of, I think, incentives to do what we can. Plus, communities, we thank the communities, and this is what our model is about, will, at a certain peer level, we think, communities will intervene. I mean, think about our families after 9/11 and so forth, families, friends, faith-based groups, rabbis, priests, ministers, try to reassure. I mean, we, communities have an incentive to bring this down, too. We see that. So I think the answer is right, and you know, we're going to see this in the near future. Think about our fears of nuclear power and what happened in the late 70s when the nuclear power industry collapsed as a result of Three Mile Island. Well, we're now coming back to this issue, and there's been work that was done by Paul Slovic and others' colleagues about the trade-off between benefits and risk. There seems to be an inverse relationship. And at this point in time, we may begin to see the benefits of nuclear power laws, but we see the perceived risk of now. So I think the answer is yes, but I'm not sure.
If you look at public policy, you also see yes. There's a limited number of things lawmakers can talk about, make laws about, worry about. So there you definitely see the concentration.
Did smoking go up after 9/11? I remember seeing a story that smoking went up after 9/11.
Making meatloaf went up. Home-based cocooning went up. So good home cooking went up.
Religion went up very noticeably.
Oh, yeah.
I apologize for continuing to direct questions at Dale, but two kind of interrelated questions. First, just factual. Did your graph really say that people in San Diego many years after 9/11 are more worried about anthrax than earthquakes? And
well, go ahead.
The second question is, I have some concerns about the measure of risk. I remember doing a study where I asked people, how much do you care about income inequality? And people have said, I care tremendously. But nobody ever mentioned income inequality spontaneously.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that what people are actually concerned about in their daily lives, what they're thinking about, what they're reacting to, can be very different from what they say is important after you draw their attention to it in a certain way.
Sure. Yeah, well, to begin with the first question, remember that we created these scenarios with the idea that an anthrax has just been released in a local theme park. So it's not way back 5 years ago. This happened.
Okay, so it doesn't incorporate probability.
No, this has actually happened. Thank you.
Because usually with risk, probability is a good element, but this is really a measure of badness.
Yeah. Yes, I think so. This is, we've asked the question in terms of perceived risk. To what degree do you feel threatened by this event? Is one of our interests. So this is an event that we ask people to imagine has happened locally. That's number one. And the second, what was the second question?
About whether when you ask people about a risk and you're drawing attention to it, you might artificially elevate their concern about that risk and also distort their relative perception of risks.
Yeah, it's a methodological challenge. And George, the thing that Paul and I are particularly trying to do is create scenarios that we can immerse people in. In fact, what I haven't gone into here is that most recently we've actually taken a news story, created these scenarios, and then measured people at the same people at different points in time where we've updated the scenario. And we've sent them emails trying to simulate, trying to immerse them. Let's pretend that this is really happening. See, because we're trying to get a handle on to what degree does perceptions of risk decay over time, too. And it's, I agree with you, it's methodologically very challenging situation.
Frank?
Yeah, this is not just to Bill, but to everybody else as well. We've been using the word bad quite a bit, but if you probe it a little bit more, there's also another dimension to that's bad, which is be more like a vehicle, which to some extent, you know, may sound, you know, sort of off the radar, but actually, where people perceive risk, you know, sort of the element of morality or the moral dimension is often missing in the analysis. And, you know, earlier on, you mentioned, somebody else mentioned the epidemics, for example. But it's very interesting that the way that people reacted to, you know, the bubonic plague was very different than the way they reacted to the smallpox epidemic in 1918 and 1919. You know, one led to witchcraft and the perception of evil. The other one was just seen as, you know, as a normal, you know, kind of health problem that nobody was particularly concerned about. And a lot of the points that people are kind of discussing, even risk perception and also elsewhere, it's really about the fact that the element of morality, you know, the evil becomes very, very important here. It's linked to intentionality, because what is intentionally done is a different bad than what is just happened. It links to the whole question of motive and also institutional responsibility. And I think that, you know, what I'm really trying to argue for is that we've got to introduce not just the emotional, but the moral dimension into the broad methodological kind of orientation.
Well, it's an interesting point, because when we ask people why they were given the answer they were on our rating scales to terrorism versus accidental stuff, and we look at our records of perceived risk and how fearful they are, the people that cited an open-ended question that they felt the terrorists were evil people, etc., had actually lower perceived risk than the people who didn't actually accept. Any guesses why that might be?
Religion?
Yeah. The thing is, and I think your colleagues at Carnegie Mellon, the Jennifer Garner and so forth, that if people are angry, they have lower perceived risk than if they're fearful. And this whole moral view is that, and this is sometimes that what we found was that particularly our white, Caucasian, but most particularly male respondents tended to give this kind of moral, I'm not going to let the terrorists influence how I think and feel. It was an angry response that lower perceived
Yeah, and just in even security, looking at people, it actually ends up, when the moral dimension gets in there, it actually gives a bias in their perception, because now they're looking for some very clear black and white bad guy, evil guy, and in some of the planning for it, they're looking for people to do evil, bad type of stuff, and those little stereotypes get into some of the planning and thinking, when in fact, you know, they're a bit more rational in the approach. I mean, the 9/11 thing was really fairly well planned out. You know, and it wasn't just simply an act of evil. And from their point of view, of course, they didn't think it evil at all. In fact, it was a righteous thing, and, you know, God was on the side of them. So, yeah, that's a little complicated.
So, let me continue picking on Bill. I'm wondering if some of the answers to the questions were about what they perceive as the risk were correlated with similarly irrational and disproportionate behavior. I mean, for example, are these people buying fewer earthquake preparedness supplies and stocking up on shark repellent?
The shark repellent. Well, you know, just to forgot to mention this. Any guesses of why people went rapidly back into the water as soon as the folks said the shark was no longer around?
Because they liked going in the water?
Was it the weather was good. I worried people. And number two, there's a hardcore element of surfers who went in the water ahead of time. And we often respond to risk in terms of social cues.
So shark bait went in.
Yeah.
And they're also out further than me.
Yeah,
so
you don't think
we didn't ask about the insurance and things like this. More recently, and I haven't looked at this data yet, because it was just a month ago we collected it, and I haven't gotten into it, but we asked about willingness to pay, having your taxes increased security and so forth. It does seem to be a positive correlation with that. I'm not an economist, so I don't, the implications of that, I'll have to confer with some of my colleagues, but if you look at California, where at least in some, well, the whole coast of California is a very, very serious earthquake risk. And yet, if you look at insurance, for earthquake insurance, my insurer tells me that less than one in seven people have earthquake insurance. And when I talked to the American Red Cross, they estimate less than 5% have 3 days of water, even minimal stock. Please.
Just a very small point on that. Living in earthquake country.
Yeah.
PG&E's expert on earthquakes, who lives next door to me, says it does make no sense to buy earthquake insurance. Get fire insurance. Because what's destroyed things is fire, not earthquake.
Yeah, you know, and I will say that I understand that. And yet I went out and bought earthquake insurance to the max. I think, you know, 10% of the deductible. Knowing economically it's not rational. Just to avoid that if it was a major earthquake and there was structural damage to my house, I would not want to feel bad. It was worth $400 to me to not worry about it, thinking I did the best I could. Knowing full well, it's not economically smart.
I know someone who only buys lottery tickets when it's cool in his office, not just thinks he'll win, because he doesn't want to be the one guy left.
To buy earthquake insurance can be explained in terms of how much more moral hazards. These people may very well rationally conclude that the taxpayers are going to cover their losses. That's been the precedent.
Well, for me, I wanted also to avoid my wife scolding me for thinking I should have known that.
It actually sounds pretty rational when you factor in all of the
rationalizing.
So, a question from Mark. Panelists earlier we talked about the base rate problem. Think about terrorists because there aren't very many of them. So I was wondering how with false positive, false negative rates, this is actually going to be useful to you. You know, say only 100,000 people who goes actually a terrorist.
Oh yeah, you look at the rates. Even on September 11th, I mean, Newark Airport has about 5,000 people an hour go through it, and so you had, you know, 4 out of 5,000 for that hour, and for the year is 4 out of 29 million.
That's one airport.
So yeah, it's small. Assume they did 2 test runs, and so now you got 8 or 12 out of 29 million, right? Either way, it's fairly small. But, yeah, I think it poses a real problem. You're just going to have this huge false positive rate. But the key is, I think, you know, when you think in terms of layers of security, as you do, you get to say, what are the frontline person's job? It's just to get them to the secondary. There's a certain number of people they can screen in a secondary interview per hour in terms of what they have the capability to do. And you just make sure you don't have any false negatives. You're going to make almost all false positive all the time. But you know, how do you go about deciding, though, who gets into that pool? Now, random is one technique you can use. Probably always good to have a little bit of randomness so that even the bad guy knows, no matter how hard they plan, there's still some obscure small chance that they're going to get caught. But just really hand them off to the next level is the key thing you need to do on that. So, again, that's... And you're trying to design your system such a way to do that. And, again, trying to use some science to help inform that decision versus mythology versus gut impression, because Paul was talking about this morning. There's been a lot of data looking at, you know, police officers and professionals and using their guts, and a lot of them are pretty bad. It's uncorrelated with their accuracy. So some are good, some are bad, just uncorrelated. But the confidence, as Paul mentioned, goes up with experience. But the accuracy stays the same. So the Amos Tversky line about often wrong but never doubt absolutely applies. So, again, because it's so small, you're going to have some, it really just providing some additional tools to try to make that decision just a little bit better, right? Something that might give you a better chance to make sure that if you do get that one malfeasant in there, that they just get to the next level where then somebody's going to can hand search that.
Shoe police will get you.
Yeah.
Andrew?
Continuing next week on Mark, since we come over. I'll focus there. You seem to be using standard psychological models for the basis of these tests. Unfortunately, when we're talking about particularly these extreme cases, we're talking about people in abnormal psychological states to start with. Somebody who is intending to commit suicide, somebody who is intending to commit a terrorist act, is not necessarily in the same psychological state as anybody that you're putting through your tests. So I do worry about the validity of this, and the claim that you're getting all false positives, no false negatives. Well, that may be true with people who are in normal psychological states, but what about the fact that you're dealing with a very small number of people in very abnormal psychological states?
Two things. First off, I would argue that some are not necessarily in an abnormal psychological state. It's something that they sort of see as a normal routine part of
like
what their mission is.
Sharing with the rest of the population.
But I will also say not all of them are going to be the same as somebody that you can try to sit down and analyze in the lab. And from what I understand about, you know, suicide bombers, they're heterogeneous, but there are the equipment failure and the moral failure is the two broad categories. Equipment failure is, you know, that guy's like, it ain't working, who gets captured. And there do seem to be some differences between that, but it's more of a talking to the security people who study this in more detail and from the Israelis' point of view and all the other kind of stuff, is that they are more in the soldier mode than they are in any kind of, I know you're not implying it's like psychotic suicidal state, but it's more of a soldier, it's a mission, it's a task you need to do. These are bad guys, you know, I don't feel anything about them. In fact, the 9/11 hijackers, everyone who had contact with them prior to that mentioned that the one word that came up over and over again was arrogance. Arrogance, disdain, this kind of, you know, hostile sort of, but again, in this
situation. Please don't tell anybody that. I'll get picked up all the time. Yeah,
like a faculty.
None of us are going to be able to fly again.
but I'm serious. But that was sort of the mindset in there. So, but those are all, I think, within the realm of normal behavior at this point. And I know what you're talking about. There's something fundamentally different about willing to blow yourself up. But I think everything we've seen here, nothing abnormal. In fact, even the Al-Qaeda banner, they screen for psychopaths. They do a lot of little techniques to screen out people who are mentally unstable. So,
well, as I said, it's briefly, but it's not the fact that they are insane. It's the fact they are not in any normal psychological condition. Mm-hmm. And I think your point about military personnel, mm-hmm, is actually possibly where you should be looking for the closest we've got in an amenable population. Rather than looking at your random person on the street or your random undergrad on your campus.
The people who do these things that we think are way out of the normal state are really very, very similar to us. Mm-hmm. Simply, they've been affected by cognitive dissonance, as I raised the issue before. We try to think that they are a different class of people, but if you start looking at them, you find that they are not very much different than us. A small motivation there.
I have a cue, so I sort of know the water. Gene, you're next.
I think it's very interesting that we're talking about trying to detect lying terrorists. When there is starting to be this huge amount of videotape of police incidents, as police start to videotape their interactions, and every year you get about 1,500 domestic terrorists, right, men who kill their spouses and who are obviously going to tell the police, not, you know, I'm planning to murder her as soon as you leave. You know, I doubt that pops up a lot. And I wonder, we're talking about psychology of security, and we're quite unlikely, and everybody we know is quite unlikely to get murdered by a terrorist, right? But we're quite likely to know somebody who, you know, if we know like 10 women, we know somebody who is a victim of this kind of abuse. And there's so much video data out there that I guess I wonder why we're not focusing on this huge, rich category of terrorist-like individuals we have.
Number one, consider criminal. Number two, most of that video is of awful quality. The vast majority of it is such that we could not do most of our analyses on it. It's a little camera in a corner, the face isn't big enough, and so...
And you're talking about crimes of passion versus...
Oh, no, most of them are planned. They're not, like, instant. That's like...
But it's the same reason why there are more... the airplanes are... We don't have enough crashes. It's a matter of socially perceived risk, and...
No, but I was asking
to do that experiment, even for the terrorists.
Why the research wasn't done, because it seems like you have a huge number of people who, you know...
Who tried. Before 9/11, the criminal stuff, no one will fund it.
Really?
Yep.
So
9/11
in the future,
is the only time we ever actually started getting significant behavioral funding to do this.
So in the future, we should never say we work on computer security. We should say we work on infectious, malignant...
Terrorist diseases.
Yeah. And digital
national
terrorism.
Diseases.
National infrastructure.
Yes.
Risk.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
effective degrees.
Yeah.
A good label.
Yeah.
That's the key.
Yeah.
I had a question for Ralph, actually, about the training. Because it seemed like at the beginning you were going to tell us a little bit about where the simulation training broke down as opposed to the Peterson leadership training as opposed to the sort of field training, and you never quite got to that point. I was curious.
There are only, I'll start with a statement that everything but war is a simulation. So, and many simulations, all simulations are wrong, many simulations are useful. And what I had to do was, given I didn't have so much money to build the giant training devices, I had to say, what can I teach in a PC? So I don't teach people to drive vehicles, but I teach people what to think about when they're driving vehicles. And give them headroom so that when the blood's flowing and the cordite, they smell the cordite, they have enough room to think about the tactics because they've gone through those processes before. So there are limits to what you can do here. You cannot get the social interactions, the facial gestures to come out of Unreal Tournament's video. And so if you're going to go further than that, you have to create those artificial things like trust meters. I created digital mood rings that moved around the characters for people. So there are lots of distinctions that you have to play when you're building those things. And that sets you up, as you have the problem, if you actually do something, then they will say, well, it doesn't transfer. I'll tell you offline some really good examples of how it does transfer.
Next was a hand back.
Who's up there?
Okay.
Under information from Mark. It's true, isn't it, that since 9/11 there's only been one threatened attack on an airplane. That was the true one. Get away with it. Has there been a single case where someone has been arrested at the airport planning a terrorist attack, and they have at the airport based on these events?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just we don't know about.
Yes.
But you do.
Yes. So I was going to ask, is it because, if it's, it hasn't been the case, is it because terrorists believe that the authorities are better at detecting than they actually are? The deterrent effect of a technique which actually isn't very effective is being very strong.
Yeah, well, there's certainly a belief amongst some of the security people that, yeah, just simply, you know, showing the force does help as a deterrent. Yeah, but the base rate is still low.
But can you give us any information on how many people have been?
I've been told by people. I won't say how many, but.
Are we talking about 3 or 30?
No, I probably should let that go.
Four quick comments. I think we should be, although there is no consensus on how to define a terrorist, I don't think we should immediately assume that it's a violent spouse abuser and a political terrorist are the same thing. Second is, take a look at the work of John Gottman, if you don't know it, on violent spouse abusers. There's quite a lot. Now, I'm not saying they're sufficient, but we know more about violent spouse abusers. That doesn't mean.
There's lots of them, you know.
There's
only a dozen terrorists.
Well, we don't know how many terrorists there are, but probably
more than
from the data I've seen, there's quite a few. Not as many as there are violent spouse abusers. Secondly, there are a substantial number of female violent spouse abusers. It isn't only male. Second quick point is the mental state of the terrorists, which you were raising over there, and how can you in any way approximate it. There's very little known of the mental state of terrorists. The best source I know is a recent Israeli book. That's about Israeli terrorists. There's no reason. And that's changed over time. So it's not such an obvious matter that they are really, in what ways they are different. I think there are research approaches that haven't been used that could help us understand why two people who've grown up in nearly identical circumstances, let's say in Manchester, in England, one becomes a terrorist and another hasn't. Quickly, it seems that we know quite a bit about political assassins who are incarcerated in the United States. There's over 80 who have tried to kill a federal official, a Supreme Court, or a president or a vice president. About a third are paranoid schizophrenic. There is a good study on that. And the last, to just get back to your question, which is there are people called behavioral detection officers who are at some of our airports watching, some of our lines. Their hit rate in terms of catching people who meet the criteria for felons is about 90% of the people that they take out of the law. It's a very small number that they take out of the law, but those that they do on the basis of the kinds of behaviors that Mark's talking about, they have a very high hit rate. How many terrorists? I've seen that data, but I'm not really disclosed.
But they haven't been put on trial, so where are they?
I can't tell you. I'm not trying to
sum that in. So the felons are put on trial. Actually, TSA occasionally write on their blog and their website when behavioral detection
officers. There was a 3 weeks ago he was put on trial. So the pipe bomb. Okay. Who they think on the basis of behavioral observation.
And the cost of people pick up felons, but that's, you know, drug infection.
Yes, but they pick up felons, they pick up weapons smugglers, they pick up money smugglers. But weapons smuggling, people who are smuggling weapons, start to lead you in the direction of terrorism. Certainly nobody wants people with weapons to go on board airplanes, do they? Anybody in this room want that?
Not that's smuggling weapons at a time.
Yeah.
Okay. Please.
You know, to respond to Paul's comment and Gene's question, ironically, probably one of the reasons we don't pay enough attention to this fossil abuse.
Well, just violent criminals. You know, they're like a huge.
Is they're part of the familiar system. It happens so much that the we think we understand emotionally. Think we understand it and control. It's not going to happen to me because I'm not in the household or whatever else. Would be rational. I think our perceptions of terrorists versus, regardless of the base rate, perceptions of terrorists versus these kind of groups are very different. Very, very different.
So with that, I'd like to end the session of the day. So thank you. Thank the speakers again.
If anyone wants to get cursed in Arabic, I can set them up on my during some break.
Actually, in general, if there are papers being discussed that you think would be useful for us, please put them in an attachment. Send them to the SHB list. I think it's a good opportunity. There's a lot